This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. I always liked Rosie the Robot Maid in the Jetsons. She did the housework and the parenting.
Looks like your room needs a good dustin', Roy boy.
Sure thing, Rosie. But watch out for my scale model of the Titan Trade Towers.
Ow! Oops! My peripheral location sensors didn't detect you, Estro.
No, oh, she was great. Well, the Hunt Library at North Carolina State University brings us one step closer to the sci-fi fantasy presented in the Jetsons, because the Hunt has robots fetching your books for you. The Hunt Library holds 1.5 million books. It's got space for more, and the books take up 1/9 of the space they would in a conventional library, and that's because you don't have to have people going in between the rows. So that asks, for us, the big question, what is a library if it's not a place where you're surrounded by books? What have libraries been, and what does the Hunt suggest that libraries can be? My first guest is Clymer Cease. He's the managing principal at the architecture firm Pierce, Brinkley, Cease & Lee, and he helped build the library, at least design it. Clymer, welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
So tell us about the robot. I mean, how does it work? How do we get our books from this library?
Well, it's called an automated storage and retrieval system. And it's basically set up on an industrial system where the robots move up and down rows and they collect bins. And inside the bins are somewhere between 40 and 50 volumes segmented by size. They're returned to a work point that's manned by students. Students take that, put it on a car truck, a book truck that's sent down to the pickup spot. Takes about 5 minutes.
That's great. So I type in, or somebody at a desk types in the title of the book, I guess.
Right, right.
Sends this arm off, uses barcodes, something like that?
Uses barcodes in, barcodes out. You can do it from your iPad. You can do it from your dorm room. It'll be waiting for you when you get there. If you're in the library, 5 minutes to pick it up.
So the robot arm picks up a bin full of books, not just one volume.
Right. It doesn't select an individual volume. Pulls the bin out. The barcode pulls it out. When the book comes back, it's barcoded back in, but that does not necessarily go to the same bin. It will, over time, store the books in the most efficient manner, so the retrieval time will actually drop.
Whoa, that's because, I guess not, I guess a lot of books don't get checked out. I mean, is that it? That some books are obviously checked out more than others.
Yeah, in most university libraries, about 80% of the volumes don't circulate but once maybe for 25 or 30 years. So a lot of books sit there, and by putting the books in the vault, we're storing them in a very dry, very quiet, secure place, so that once every 30 years that somebody wants to look at that book, it's there and it's in great shape.
Wow. But this used to be the mortal sin of librarians, right? Putting the book in the wrong place, you might as well have thrown the book away.
Well, that's right. A lot of books were misfiled over the years, and you had to get lucky to find it, or you had to send a lot of students, workers through the stacks looking for misfiled books.
And so now it doesn't matter. It's going to be in a different bin every time, and generally moving forward as there's a kind of Google algorithm going on.
There's kind of an algorithm working, that's correct.
Yeah. And so, but it's more, and in a way, I mean, robotics, that's kind of the future of the past, isn't it? I mean, that's industrial technology meets this.
It is. And the irony of it is that the robots are used to create more space for humans. I mean, that's the whole point of the system.
And we'll talk about that space. But, you know, as we did the research on this and thought about doing this show, every time we turned around, people said, well, you got to talk to Susan Nutter then. If you don't talk to Susan Nutter, you're not going to get the whole story. Susan is often credited as the key visionary behind the library. She's vice provost and director of libraries at North Carolina State. She arrived at State, and when she got there, their libraries were ranked 101st compared to the peers by the Association of Research Libraries. And then under her leadership, North Carolina State Libraries climbed to number 27 in North America. And if you think that's something, wait till you hear this. During the recession, Susan convinced the North Carolina State faculty to forego personal salary increases, and instead the money was funneled to develop the North Carolina State Library. So she couldn't join us live on the program. She was busy Dewey decimating, I guess. So I spoke to her earlier today and asked her about her vision for the library.
Well, as you know, Frank, that every great university also has a very strong library that's central to its really to its greatness. And so our vision for the library was to be a competitive advantage for the university, and especially for the students and faculty, for recruitment and retention of students and faculty, and to help students when they graduated to have that extra edge in getting a position and getting into graduate school. And that's really what we wanted to be. It's taken a long time to get there. And we did it first by improving the library itself in terms of collections and services. We did that extensively. And then an opportunity came to build the Hunt Library.
Well, you know, I had to ask you, what is it that makes a great library? What guarantees that retention? Is it the volumes? Is it the books that you have on the shelves? Is it the space that it's in? What's a great library?
Well, it's changed over time. I would say that historically, it's great collections. And that is what has made universities possible, allowed them to attract top faculty. But it's changed over time, and services have become more and more important. And I think in the last two decades, we've realized how important space is. And in the last decade, it has been the issue of collaborative space, space where people across disciplines can work together and really interact, be innovative, creative, in really much more non-traditional ways.
It's interesting that this high-tech library in the digital age, when we were so worried that we'd all be on our iPhones getting information for ourselves, is the thing that sells it precisely is that you're bringing people together to work
that's
together.
That's right, and that's why I never worried. Because, well, I was at MIT before I came here. I was very used to an environment of computing, networking, and I knew that people needed to come together. I mean, that was just so clear. So I think a library has a very strong future if it does the right things in terms of the kind of space it has or the way that it serves people. But I think it's a very exciting future.
Does it matter that this is an engineering library? Could you apply this theory to, you know, sort of a literary library, a literary space?
Oh, absolutely. And this really isn't an engineering library. I mean, it has engineering collections. It's with the engineering and textiles campus. But actually, it's a second main library. We have one for main campus, one for Centennial. And anybody can come to either library.
Describe for us how students are able to work more collaboratively in this particular library.
Well, I think it's the way the space is arranged. And in particular, we have almost 100 group study rooms with all of the technology that is possible to have in the space and the walls you can write on. And you see them head right for that as soon as they come in. And this is the way students are working today. And they really take advantage of these. And it's very impressive to see large groups of students in those rooms working and learning together, teaching each other. But all of our other spaces are sort of configured in the same way. We have two monitors on every workstation in the library. And there's opportunity to bring chairs together and work together at workstations. And then we have all of these different technology spaces, which allow both large-scale and smaller-scale collaboration, doing visualization, immersion, gaming, 3D printing. So it's really fun. It's fun to go to the library.
Are you getting a lot of interest from other libraries? I mean, is this the library of the future?
Well, that's for someone else to decide, I guess. But no, the interest is huge, is absolutely huge. And the Association of Research Libraries is meeting in the Triangle in April, and we're going to have a dinner for them in Hunt. But we're having tomorrow a day for librarians and library staff from across the state to come to Hunt, and they're coming in buses. And no, we can't even keep up with the visitors, and we had to create a position for a visitor experience librarian who actually manages all of that.
A visitor experience librarian?
Right, nice. Right. We also have a concierge.
Oh, this is great. This really is the library of the future.
We couldn't afford to keep going with service desks throughout the library. Right. So we have one sort of space when you come in where you can ask for help, and there's a concierge to sort of perform triage, but we bring the help to you. And there are iPads on walls throughout the building. You tell us what you need. We bring it to you.
Susan, congratulations on this. Thanks for talking with us.
It's a lot of fun, Frank. Thanks. Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. That was Susan Nutter, Vice Provost and Director of Libraries at North Carolina State University. Here with me in the studio, Clymer Cease, Managing Principal at the architecture firm Pierce Brinkley Cease and Lee. They helped build the library. So, Clymer, talk about this designing space for collaboration. I mean, what kind of thought is it? It's not just a giant hall with conduit for computer wires. Right?
That's correct. And let me be sure to point out that Snohetta, a Norwegian firm with New York office, and we work with Craig Dykers and his folks from that office, were our collaborator on this. They were the design lead. We were the architect here. But we put a collaborative team around this with the whole notion of we need to create spaces that can be adapted by the students, by the faculty, to use any way they want to. And that means dozens of different kinds of spaces, things that can allow technology to evolve. For example, when we started designing this, iPad didn't exist. There was no iPad, but we knew something was going to. So let's create flexibility in the building that allows for the technology to be as flexible as the furniture and the types of spaces we created. So we went through, and listening to Susan was great. She's truly a visionary in terms of how libraries need to work. She said, we've got to create these kinds of spaces because students, faculties need these. So we worked to create a multitude of options.
Sounds like a great space and a fabulous idea, Clymer. So good to talk with you. Thanks for being on the program.
Glad to be here.
Clymer Cease, Managing Principal at the architecture firm Pierce, Brinkley, Cease and Lee. They helped build the Hutt Library. On the State of Things today, we're talking about the modern library, past and future. Just ahead, what do the Library of Alexandria and Google have in common? We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about how libraries are changing, what they were, what they're becoming. My next guest is Ken Hillis. Ken's a professor of media and technology studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He co-wrote a book called Google and the Culture of Search. Ken Hillis is on the program right now. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks.
You have compared the Tower of Babel, the Library of Alexandria, and Google. Make the connection for us.
What we were trying to do was to argue that search technologies like Google don't exist in a historical or a cultural vacuum. And so we were looking at the desire for a universal library over time. And I guess we could sort of think that Google today is maybe the closest realization to this ancient ideal. And it's interesting to think the Library of Alexandria still enjoys a huge kind of cultural resonance, right? We speak about it, probably most of your listeners understand what it was. And it's almost that its mythic status is more important today than any actual library that may have existed. But it was the first concerted effort to draw together, in the way that Google is doing in a slightly different way, all the information of the world.
And tell us about it. This was the Greeks' idea. They put this in Alexandria, Egypt, which is part of their growing empire. So why did the Greeks think this was a good idea, and what was in that library?
If you think the library is founded just as Alexander achieves maximum spatial expansion of the what we would call the Greek Empire, and Soter I, the first of the Ptolemies, was a Macedonian general under Alexander, and they realized that in order to rule all of these various peoples who they had conquered, all of whom spoke many languages, that they needed to gather all of the books in one place. Now, the Greeks themselves made no effort to learn the various languages of the various peoples who they had conquered, but they realized that in order to rule effectively, they had to be able to read the materials. And so the library, first of all, was a place to bring all materials together, but then to translate it. And by translating into the Greek, they understood that they would have a better effective ability to rule. So the library is, right from the get-go, a power mechanism. Right?
Is this a new idea, the idea that you somehow have to understand the people who you are now dominating? It seems to me that there was a time, perhaps, that force alone, understand this. Here's the end of my sword. Where's the gold? But apparently somebody figured out it might be easier if you get to know these people.
I can't necessarily speak to the history of that, but it is interesting to consider that in 323 BCE, they had already figured that out. Now, we may have forgotten that over time, and but we seem to be remembering it again.
What was in those books? Were these the myths of people? Were there what we would consider science, the kind of science the Greeks were developing at the time?
Everything.
Yeah.
And so we may think, for example, that the library itself was a huge translation facility, but it was also a center of research. And it believed that it was constructing what they termed at the time a grid of knowledge. And so the library is the place where there was an early understanding that the Earth revolved around the sun, or the notion of longitude was understood. But everything, wills, epistolary accounts, travel accounts, documents, commercial transactions, forgeries, you name it. And so there became a kind of bibliographic, almost a monomaniacal interest on the part of the royals to attract all this information into one place.
And who used the library?
Who used the library? Well, it's a good question, because it wasn't necessarily the public. And I think we now have an understanding that a library exists to serve a public good. And in many ways, the adjective public is sort of forgotten, but a library need not really be public. We can think of, in the United States, there are lots of private libraries that qualify. So the library was, in a sense, we might consider it a department of royal governance, right? So there were, we can't really think of the librarians who toiled there as middle-class professionals. They were, in a sense, slaves. They were looked after very well, but there are some historical examples of people who tried to leave who were captured and brought back, right? So they lived in a velvet cage. But basically providing information to the government, if you wish, about what people in certain areas would think, or, you know, the kinds of customs, and so in that sense could help day-to-day governance.
Valued more for their skills as translators, perhaps, than as retrievers, people who filed and kept track of books.
Yes, and at the same time, though, even in the day, the fact that the library existed, and there were royal libraries in all the Greek capitals, but the Alexandrian one was the daddy. And it accrued tremendous prestige to the Greeks and to their hegemony more broadly. Right?
I'm wondering what the reaction was when Greek conquerors would take these books out of their native place and bring them there. Was there, it was very expensive to make a book, and this might, have all of the documents. There might be wills, there could be deeds in there. Was it a struggle? Was it a fight to get those books out?
I think many of the books were just taken.
Yeah.
But there was certainly what we might call internecine and interinstitutional rivalry. What a lot of the subsidiary libraries were ordered to do was to make copies, right? And there's an interesting, almost humorous example that Alexandria itself was also a major port. And so the royals issued a decree that any ship docking in the port, if it had any kind of, and everything is at this point in manuscript scrolls, call them books, that these scrolls had to be made available to the library. The library would copy the scrolls. If the copy was well done, the original owner of the book would get the copy back and the library would keep the original. And so there was this sense of so there are, we could say that there are issues of improper copying.
Copyright law is a little lax at the
Copyright
time.
Copyright law is a little lax,
yeah.
Just like today.
I would think this might delay your departure a little bit, depending on how long it took you to copy that scroll or scrolls.
Perhaps.
Well, so, and that was the other question I was going to ask was, is it multimedia? Were they clay tablets and parchments and scrolls? But apparently all scrolls.
It's mostly scrolls, mm-hmm. Yes. And they understood themselves. They originally... Within the first Ptolemy's lifetime, they had managed to attract around 200,000 scrolls, but they understood that they needed about 500,000 scrolls, and they thought at that point they would have a kind of rough and ready collection of all the information in the world.
You said that this library itself kind of looms at large. It's kind of become a myth in our own imaginations. Even the destruction of Alexandria is controversial, and yet we want it to be destroyed in some conflagration. Tell us about that myth and what that says about us.
Well, I think it may, without being totalizing, it may suggest something about human nature in general, that when any one institution achieves such power, right? So this, or any kind of totality or universality. I mean, it's interesting. The history of ancient libraries almost always ends in flames. And while we're not sure that the library at Alexandria burned down or not, it probably just slowly deteriorated over time as the Egyptian monarchy deteriorated and Hellenism failed and the rise of the Romans. But I think that when things achieve a kind of mythic status, this is why I think the myth of Alexandria remains salient, that it is an image of universality. It's an image of hubris in a sense. And the history of these attempts to create a one-way approach to information end in failure.
And to control the information, to exercise your control. Well, I guess that brings us then, you talked about hubris, that brings us to the Tower of Babel. Is that the connection here and why you brought them together in your book?
That's right. The Tower of Babel is an interesting myth. You know, the account is in Genesis in the Bible. Christian exegesis understands the myth largely as an indiction against hubris. More secular accounts understand that it is a story of the beginning of linguistic diversity or the rise of nations. What interested me is a combination of these origin accounts, if you will, where you see there is basically an interdiction against human beings achieving at that time the power of God, which is also the power of universality, right? And so the scattering of the nations or the confounding of tongues, if you will, can be interpreted as the rise of pluralism, if you wish, that information gets distributed across a number of different platforms called languages, and that people then have to struggle to translate, right? But the tower is also interesting because there are authorities who suggest that it may have been built of clay brick and imprinted with cuneiform writing, right? So the actual tower itself was a kind of data storage device, right? And what's interesting out of the Tower of Babel myth is where you see that the issue of language and the confounding of language is connected in some way to the notion of sort of a universal tongue, is connected to a universal library, if you want. And over time, the longstanding desire for, say, a universal language has given way to a universal library. And what's interesting there at Alexandria, you see that it's immediately involved in translation. And this is also what's interested me with respect to Google, where you see that its massive scanning of books in the Google Books project has largely benefited the firm by providing it with a huge number of books in many, many languages that have been scanned. And the Google Books project is providing invaluable information for Google Translate, right? Because they could never have achieved such a real-time database of all these different, and the algorithms allow them to do comparative searching across language structures. And if you've used Google Translate, it works actually rather well.
Well, provided you really know what that Dutch phrase means, you're hoping for the best,
right?
You know, but let me ask you this: so is this it—the Holy Grail that we've achieved? What the builders of the Tower of Babel failed, where they failed, we're on the verge of a universal library, a broad and democratic sharing of all information, once and for all.
That's the myth. I mean, I don't want to sound like a Cassandra, because in our book we actually try to take a neutral stance towards Google the company, and we understand that it is in many ways driven I mean, it's a commercial company. It's a private firm that we largely conceive of as a public good, which is a very interesting contradiction, if you will, that raises all kinds of interesting questions about money, power, and politics. But I think the same thing obtains in that, do we as a society, does the world really wish there to be one source of information, or would we wish that there were plural sources? It isn't as though there aren't plural sources. Even on the web now, there are any number of public initiatives, such as World Digital Library, you know, founded by UNESCO and Library of Congress, or the Open Book Alliance and HathiTrust in the U.S. But
where does Wikipedia fit in all of that?
Wikipedia is there as well. I mean, there are some people who say that Wikipedia represents the kind of democratization of the Library of Alexandria. Part of it is the storage mechanism. Would we really wish that everything be held only in electronic form? With respect to the notion of Google as a universal library, we come back again to the fact that over time, the desire for a universal library was always understood to be something that would be produced by, in a way, a public, by a government, if you wish. And what's interesting, we now live at a moment where there's, in the United States at least, where there's this incredible suspicion of government and the feeling that it can't do anything right. And somehow there's a rise in the last 25 years of belief that corporations do things better. And Google is a for-profit firm.
Well, it's not, and it's not transparent. They can do whatever they want behind their closed doors and massage and manipulate the information any way they want. And there's no accountability to us about the way the information is searched, it's saved, it's retrieved, none of it, right?
And what is different than in the past, I mean, we argue that what Google does is collapse older meanings of the archive, the library, and the index. And what is different now is that we become the information as well. It's not as though, you know, if you use Google Books, you see that there are actually pre-1923 books that have passed out of copyright, are largely available. Post-1923 books depends on the kinds of negotiations that have been made with publishers. There's still ongoing lawsuits. But also every time we enter a search term, we become part of Google's archive that can be used for recording, transcription, review, sale. I mean,
and significantly, we don't have access to that. You have to buy that.
You have to buy that. And what's interesting is Pew Research has done work on when you search on Google and you see that they do distinguish by color and by arrangement on the space of the page when an ad is paid ads and what are called organic search returns. But over 65% of people don't understand the difference. Right?
Well, and those organic search returns are based on an interesting algorithm, and that is to say the most popular. And you suggest that we need to think deeply about what's happening there too.
Right. The algorithm is actually called PageRank, and it's trademarked. It actually does originally come from academic research. The fellow named Eugene Garfield, who considered himself an information scientist, who had been very influenced by H.G. Wells' interwar proposal for a permanent world encyclopedia, which he later called the World Brain. But the technology of the time wasn't really able to support the idea. So in the early 1950s, they look with early forms of computerization and databases at the fact that academics can no longer rely on whether an article is worth looking at. There's too much information. So they try to create a ranking system so that, say we're in physics, that I can understand which article on this subject I might wish to see and which I might not wish to see. And so what they do is they go in and teams of people actually count in an article the number of times that it references another article, and then they look at the number of times that it is referenced. So we have a relevance. Is the article relevant or not? And so Immediately in the early 1950s, there's critique of this because what happens is articles that the collective, if you wish, elevate to top rank, okay, they may be the most important articles, but they may not be. It may be that you are politically out of favor and so that your article doesn't get published in the right journal, or, you know, there are many, many reasons why your article might not have as many citations as the next one.
And it really creates kind of an echo effect for us as we're looking for information and hearing the same things over and over again, not getting much variety.
So the PageRank algorithm, I mean, we should really think of thousands of algorithms at Google, but it still largely operates in this way where the more times, so if you want your particular website to be privileged by Google's crawlers and spiders, you would have as many links in and out as possible. And so that's why when you do a search for, say, something like Library of Alexandria, one of the first things that's going to come up is Wikipedia, because Wikipedia has so many hot links in and out, right?
I'm going to take a break right now and return to this conversation with Ken Hillis, a professor of media and technology studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His book is called Google and the Culture of Search. We'll talk more about that, libraries, information, as our conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. This hour talking about libraries. The Hunt Library as a state-of-the-art example of architecture and technology. The Library of Alexandria is one of our early attempts to gather information together and get a global library put in one place. Ken Hillis is a professor of media and technology studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He co-wrote Google and the Culture of Search. And we're talking about, you know, Google's algorithm or algorithms that bring you the most searched answers, the most looked at answers. And it does seem to me that it narrows the scope of what you may find. And the other thing is that Google knows who I am, so it tailors its response to other searches that I've made. It's got some information about me.
And you could say that the narrowing of the scope is exactly what is needed. I was mentioning before the break the early 1950s research on creating what is now called Social Science Index and Web of Science, that most academics rely on in order to find articles and how they've been used and the amount of citation in order to determine reliability. And that's set up in the early 1950s, even going back to the Second World War. And information theorists like Vannevar Bush understand there's so much information, you can't search it. So there's a huge sense of frustration, even despair. And this is reflected in Borges' notion of the Library of Babel, right, which is got all the books in the world, but nobody can find anything because it's just chaotic. And so we do need to have some form of system of streamlining or categorization. There is a robust discussion or a good question as to how the information should be categorized. And so we can think of, in conventional libraries, Dewey Decimal System, Library of Congress, organized by categories that human beings have put into place, right? So Afghanistan history, yeah. Afghanistan war, Afghanistan royalty. When we come to automated forms of search, we move to a system where, like the early 50s example of the physics articles, your past, in a sense, comes to be very important in terms of what will be given to you. And so if we think of I'm searching on Google sees my ISP address, it knows where I am, it knows I'm in North Carolina. It's going to give me slightly different information in North Carolina than if I'm signing on in California. Very different across national borders.
All of that sounds very efficient in some ways. Maybe that is the tailored information I'm looking for. I don't want to know what this might mean in Northern Ireland. North
right.
Carolina is where I am. On the other hand, let's talk about that chaos for a minute, because, and this is something you mentioned during the break, the idea that the automated library, the automated search brings up precisely the result you were looking for. It precludes any possibility of my tripping over a title that I hadn't known about because I was walking through the stacks, reached for my book, saw the title next door and said, oh, that looks interesting.
Right. And without knowing more about the Hunt Library in Raleigh, my concern would be that they have moved partway towards some kind of more informational or digital storage of books in that it's great if you know the title of the book. And there are a lot, there are human being librarians on hand to help you there, right? But the great value of books in a library, and what we seem to be seeing with Hunt, is a move away from the notion of a collection, which I heard the librarian speak about, and more towards a space of association. The great value of the storage facility is to be able to go, everything is organized according to Library of Congress. Say I'm looking at books on 1940s film, I know to go to Davis Library on the fifth floor, and there is row after row after row, all organized right near each other. And so I might, say, be looking for a particular book. I might think that's the one that's really going to help me. And when I get there, I see that, no, in fact, it's the book that's five to the left. Mm-hmm. That's really what I was looking for.
Well, and to be clear, there are many, many collections. There will be upwards of 2 million volumes at some point in this library. So the books are still important, and the tangible media are still there. It's just the search and delivery is a little bit different. And as you point out, the tripping over or accidentally finding. On the other hand, Amazon is always very good at telling me about books that, if I like that one, a lot of other people like this one too. And that's a version of that, isn't it, in a way?
In a way. Amazon, too, though, is also basing its suggestions to you on relevance. It understands what you have searched. It understands what most people are searching. But it might be not only with respect to Google, where you're typing in some kind of information like, what job shall I take? Or typing in, or I don't imagine that you can use Amazon very efficiently to find books that you don't know the title. And so relevant searching is fantastic if you know what you're looking for. If you don't know what you're looking for, and it might be precisely that text that you don't know the name of, or maybe it's in a foreign language, or maybe the search term that you entered isn't just quite right, it's not going to give it to you, right?
Well, I'm going to bring into the conversation right now Barbara Moran. She was a librarian. Now she trains future librarians as a professor at UNC Chapel Hill School of Information and Library Science. Barbara Moran, welcome.
Thank you very much.
How has the public library, the public use of library, changed over time in your career? How has that changed, or has it?
Well, it certainly has. I think libraries as organizations have changed a great deal just because of the introduction of all the electronic material. So when I came to Chapel Hill in the 80s, there was not an online catalog. You went to the card catalog. You went to paper indexes to look for journal articles when you're looking for them. And all of that has been completely revolutionized by electronic technology now. You can look a book up in the card catalog, and you can go up to the stacks and look up there if you want to, but when you look it up, you know whether the book is in or out. So that I think libraries have been completely transformed by these information technologies that are so common now that we all depend on.
All for the better, would you say?
Well, you know, I think mostly for the better. Now, obviously, there are some things that have been left behind, but when you think about the convenience to the user of these technologies, I think that's why we have them. The purpose of libraries has always been to try to connect information, a person's need to their information, and I think that with this, it's much, much easier to do it. Now, you do sometimes, I agree with Ken, going up to the stacks and looking at books around and, you know, serendipitously finding new material is a lot of fun, but it's so very, very convenient to look it up in an online catalog and sometimes even have the librarians fetch the books for you. I know that at the Hunt Library, they no longer are able to browse the way we're able to browse in most libraries, but they do have a form of what they're calling virtual browsing, that you can see not only the book that you would be, that you are interested in, but you'd see the books that would be arranged around that book.
Well, that's interesting. So you could very easily create a categorical collection that you could see online. You could look at titles, maybe even look at their bindings. Why not?
You could. The thing is, you wouldn't be able to do is take the book down and actually page through it. I mean, the thing that typically I think browsers do. But they're trying to recreate that browsing experience.
Although I would think that that's technologically, you can certainly do that if you wanted to and limit the number of pages the way Amazon sort of gives you a sample and you can say, well, you know, check it out, read these five pages.
You probably could.
and do that. But so Ken, would that solve part of that problem? The idea that there would be a virtual collection sorted by category?
That would solve part of the problem, because yes, it's fun to browse, but it's also essential to research. And what's interesting, hearing Google, for example, and Sergey Brin, one of the co-founders, wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times in 2007 called A Library to Last Forever, where he argues for the digitization of books. And he makes quite disparaging remarks about storage facilities in contemporary libraries when he says, you know, they just languish there, forgotten, right? And moldering away. And as your earlier guest spoke, many of these books might not be looked at but every 20 or 30 years. But the people who are looking for them know how to find them. And so there's some kind of disparaging remark made in general about research libraries, because that's what they do. They are the archive, in a sense. They are the storage of the collective knowledge. Now, you could say that's a fantastic hubris or a fantastic kind of metaphysics to think we can store this kind of information. But if you accept that we should store it, it will likely always be what we would call an elite of people who know how to search it. Most people aren't going to want to look for that 1881 insurance manual. But the people who are looking for it will probably know how to find it, and a reference librarian will assist them if they don't.
So that means, Barbara, I guess that we have not lost. The librarian will not go the way of the dodo.
I don't think the librarian will go the way of the dodo. If anything, librarians are more needed now than ever before. There is just such a surfeit of information available, and I think the librarian does what librarians have always done. They, in a way, they collect the information, they organize the information, they preserve the information, and then they provide access to the information for the user. And that's so important, not just in academic and scholarly libraries, but in public libraries and school libraries and other types of libraries where we don't have really sophisticated users coming to the library.
How has library science changed? I mean, it does seem to me that all of us have become a little better at typing in searches. And if you've done it for any length of time, you kind of know what to include and what to leave out so you don't get too much junk. It seems to me we're getting a little better at this as non-professionals. What does the librarian do, and how has library science changed in light of the technological changes?
Well, I think our field has just really been revolutionized. Our students still learn to do the things that librarians always did, you know, how to organize information, how to connect the user to the information. But in addition, they come out with a whole wealth of knowledge of all the technology that's going to be used in the library and how to use that technology as a tool to provide better library services, because that is really what we're looking for. We're trying to provide the best service to the user, regardless of the tool. And if it's technology, if it's an electronic format, oftentimes that's a better way of providing it to a user.
Ken, do you think, Barbara, I'll ask you this question as well, but I want to start with Ken. The fact that it is easier now to get information, it's not on cards, it can be done very quickly and accessed much more quickly, even by individuals, by the students themselves, does that make students better researchers, or does that somehow make them not as good? Does it have an impact on how good we are as researchers when you're a student?
I think ideally or theoretically it should make students better researchers. However, I have had the unfortunate experience a number of times over the last 10 years of having undergraduates tell me that they feel so lucky they have never gone beyond the lobby of the library. And they're in the lobby or they're in the public areas because they're meeting with friends to do the kind of collective work that your previous guest spoke about. But I now, on student research papers, mandate that they must have 4 to 6 non-internet sourced books to force them into the library. And they hate it, right?
Yeah.
They absolutely hate it. And they feel that somehow they're being forced into some kind of antique mechanism that bears little relation to their lives, and largely believe that everything is on Google, even though there's a kind of split consciousness because they know it's not. And what I have sensed in the kind of zeitgeist of young adults who are the undergraduate population at UNC, that there's a kind of background concern that everything's available through the internet, and yet it is, and we've heard the notion of convenience raised. It's the meta ideology of the day. convenience, right? And so, but must convenience always trump? Is there not sometimes when a little more work is required to get at that democratic possibility of knowledge?
Well, is it required? I wonder about that. I mean, when I was writing papers in college, it was hard work. Lots of index cards. You had to keep track of them. You had to get your footnotes all lined up. And it was, and they were not digital, so they all had to be entered manually. It was really, really hard work. And you needed that much a commitment, I guess, to the paper just to get yourself started. Forget about writing it, synthesizing and all this stuff. So Barbara, does it make better researchers of us all, or does it, as Ken suggests, build in a kind of a laziness that may make us not the highest quality student?
I think we are also spoiled. I think it's just amazing to think about what we have access to now, just from our desk or just from a library catalog, that at one time would have taken, you know, weeks of work, just as you say. So we are all spoiled, and I think especially with beginning scholars, sometimes, you know, students, freshmen come and they think everything's on Google. I believe that it's professors and librarians oftentimes are able to move them beyond that. But you see this happening even at a lower level. I mean, in the school libraries, in the public libraries, people come in, they just expect immediate access to material now that once would never have been available to them. The world of information has just opened up to everyone, and it's great. It may make us lazier, but I think we all have so much better access than we did, say, 20 years ago.
And are we making good use of it, do you think?
I think many people are making good use of it. I look not only at academic libraries, but I spend a lot of time at public libraries, and I look at people going there and accessing either from the library itself or actually even from home through various networks, things like Consumer Reports, using it to get information they really do need. In the public library, you see people, the library provides a place for people to apply for jobs. And to me, libraries are a lot of things, but the three main things they are the place. And I think we have a great example of that in the Hunt Library. There's also the collections, both the print and the electronic, but they're the services. And I think in all three of these areas, we are, you know, much more fortunate than we used to be with all the wealth of resources that are available to us.
I want to thank you both for being on the program today. Barbara Moran is professor at UNC Chapel Hill School of Information Library Science. Ken Hillis is a professor of Media and Technology Studies at UNC Chapel Hill and co-wrote Google and the Culture of Search. Ken and Barbara, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things. If you want to hear more or hear an archived edition of a past program, our website is stateofthings.org. Our program is directed by Alex Granados and produced by Sean Wen, Nicole Campbell, and Dave DeWitt. Christina Blyde, I should say, is our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director. Brent Wolfe, WNC's news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.